and women. But for breast cancer, our findings, representing 8 prospective studies, suggest a possible modest increase in breast cancer risk with egg consumption. Breast cancer risk was found to increase by 22% with every 100 gram per day increment of egg consumption, about 2 eggs. There was a 67% increase in risk for the nurse's health study. But earlier, the Harvard researchers took a slightly different position. Among healthy men and women, moderate egg consumption can be part of a nutritious and balanced diet. The nurse's health study then came up with an even more powerful endorsement for eggs, as a news item stated. Eating eggs during adolescence could protect women against breast cancer. The article goes on to quote a Harvard researcher as saying, "Women who had during adolescence a higher consumption of eggs had a lower risk of breast cancer." Most people who read this news article will likely say that eggs are back in favor, even when they don't know how many eggs per day are okay or whether there are exceptions to this generalization. Eggs will only seem to be more healthful when the henhouse industry adds their words of wisdom. But wait a minute. Evidence says egg consumption for teenage girls is okay, maybe even good. But evidence also says more egg consumption overall increases breast cancer risk. By the way, here's something else to think about. Multiple studies have rather consistently shown that egg consumption can increase colon cancer risk, more so for women than for men. What are we to believe? One minute, alcohol intake can reduce our disease risks. The next minute, it can increase them. One minute, fish consumption can help to reduce our disease risks. The next minute, it can hurt. One minute, eggs are bad. The next minute, they can be healthy. It seems to me that what is missing here is the larger context. What you have without that context is just a lot of confusion. Unraveling diet and cancer. In addition to stating that diet and exercise are unrelated to breast cancer, the Harvard researchers have been chipping away at other popular notions regarding diet and cancer. For example, the Harvard studies have not been able to detect any association between colorectal cancer and fiber or fruit and vegetable intake. Dietary fiber, of course, only comes from plant-based foods. Thus, these findings put a dent in the idea that fiber or fruits, vegetables, and cereals prevent large bowel cancer. Keep in mind that the Harvard studies are dealing with uniformly carnivorous populations, almost none of which are using a whole foods, plant-based, WFPB, diet that is naturally low in fat and high in fiber. It is likely that the potential protective effect of fiber or fruits and vegetables does not kick in against colorectal cancer until there is a complete dietary shift away from an animal-based diet. Between the colon cancer and breast cancer findings, the nurse's health study has done much to confuse, if not discredit, the idea that diet is related to cancer. After these decades of work, Professor Walt Willett says, "Increasing fruits and vegetables overall appears to be less promising as a way to substantially reduce cancer risk. The benefits of these foods appear greater for cardiovascular disease than for cancer." This statement sounds a bit ominous. Colon cancer, historically one of the first cancers said to be prevented by a plant-based diet, now is being described as unrelated to diet? And low-fat diets don't prevent breast cancer? With results like these, it's only a matter of time before the hypothesis of a dietary connection to cancer starts falling apart. In fact, I have already heard people within the scientific community beginning to say that diet may have no effect on cancer. These are the reasons that I believe that the nurse's health study has done considerable damage to the nutrition landscape. It has virtually nullified many of the advances that have been made over the past 50 years without actually posing a scientifically reliable challenge to earlier findings regarding diet and cancer. This problem of studying a population that uniformly consumes a high-risk diet and looking at the differences in consumption one nutrient at a time is not unique to the nurse's health study. it is common to virtually all studies using Western subjects. Furthermore, there is little or no value to pooling the results of many large studies for analysis in order to get a more reliable result if all the studies have the same flaw. A pooling strategy is often used for identifying cause and effect associations that are more subtle and uncertain within single studies. This is a reliable assumption when each study is properly done, but obviously not when all the studies are similarly flawed. The combined results only give a more reliable picture of the flaw. The Harvard researchers have done several of these multi-study pooled analyses. One such pooled analysis concerned the question of whether meat and dairy foods had any effect on breast cancer. A previous 1993 pooling of 19 studies had shown a modest, statistically significant 18% increase in breast cancer risk with increased meat intake and 17% increase with increased milk intake. The Harvard researchers therefore summarized in 2002 a more recent group of studies, this time including 8 large prospective studies where dietary information was thought to be more reliable, and where a much larger group of women was included. The researchers concluded, "We found no significant association between intake of meat or dairy products and risk of breast cancer." Most people would say, "Well, that's it. There is no convincing evidence that meat and dairy foods are associated with breast cancer risk." But let's take another look at this supposedly more sophisticated analysis. All 8 of these studies represented diets that had a high proportion of animal-based foods. In effect, each study in this pool was subject to the same flaw from which the nurse's health study suffered. It makes no sense and does no good to combine them. In spite of there being 351,041 women and 7,379 breast cancer cases in this mega database, these results cannot detect the true effects of diets rich in meat and dairy on breast cancer risk. This would be true even if there were a few million subjects in the study. Like the nurse's health study, these studies all involved typical Western diets, highly skewed toward the consumption of animal-based foods, where people are tinkering with the intake of only one nutrient or one food at a time. Each study failed to take into account a broader range of dietary choices, including those that demonstrated positive effects on breast cancer risk in the past. Ignoring my critique. Once, after reading a publication on animal protein and heart disease in the Nurses' Health Study, I published a critique summarizing some of the same points that I am making in this chapter, including the inability of the Nurses' Health Study to advance our understanding of the original international correlation studies. The lead authors responded, and our exchange is as follows. First, my comment. Within a dietary range so rich in animal-based foods, it makes no sense to me that it is possible to reliably detect the so-called independent associations of the individual constituents of this group, when it can be expected that they share the same disease outcomes, and when there are so many difficult-to-measure and interacting risk factor exposures. When will it be understood that it is the total diet and the aggregate and comprehensive effects of large food groups that make the greatest contribution to the maintenance of health and prevention of disease? The sort of reductionism embodied in the interpretation of data from this Nurses' Health Study cohort runs the risk of severely misleading discourse on meaningful public health and public policy programs. Then the response from Dr. Hu and Professor Willett. Although we agree that overall dietary patterns are also important in determining disease risk, we believe that identification of associations with individual nutrients should be the first step, because it is these specific compounds or groups of compounds that are fundamentally related to the disease process. Specific components of diet can be modified, and individuals and the food industry are actively doing so. Understanding the health effects of specific dietary changes, which Campbell refers to as reductionism, is therefore an important undertaking. I agree that studying the independent effects of individual food substances, their identities, functions, mechanisms, is worthwhile. But Willett and I sharply disagree with how to interpret and use these findings. I strongly reject the implications in Willett's argument that specific components of the diet can be modified to the benefit of one's health. This is precisely what is wrong with this area of research. In fact, if the nurse's health study shows nothing else, it demonstrates that modifying the intake of one nutrient at a time, without questioning whole dietary patterns, does not confer significant health benefits. Women who tinker with fat, while maintaining a near carnivorous diet, do not have a lower breast cancer risk. This gets to the heart of reductionism in science. As long as scientists study highly isolated chemicals and food components and take the information out of context to make sweeping assumptions about complex diet and disease relationships, confusion will result. Misleading news headlines about this or that food chemical and this or that disease will be the norm. The more impressive message about the benefits of broad dietary change will be muted as long as we focus on relatively trivial details. On occasion, when our paths have crossed, Professor Willett and I have had discussions about the findings on fat as they relate to the China study and the nurse's health study. I have always made the same point. WFPB diets, naturally low in fat, are not included in the nurse's health study cohort, and that it is these types of diets that are the most beneficial for our health. Professor Willett has said to me in response, on more than one occasion, "You may be right, Colin, but people don't want to go there." This comment has disturbing implications. Scientists should not be ignoring ideas just because we perceive that the public does not want to hear them. Too often during my career, I have heard comments that seem to be more of an attempt to please the public than to engage in an open, honest debate, wherever it may take us. This is wrong. The role of science in a society is to observe, to ask questions, to form and test hypotheses, and to interpret the findings without bias, not to kowtow to people's perceived desires. Consumers have the ultimate choice of whether to integrate our findings into their lifestyles, but we owe it to them to give them the best information possible with which to make that decision and not decide for them. It is they who paid for this research, and it is only they who have the right to decide what to do with it. The perception in the scientific community that the public only wants magic bullets and simple dietary tinkering is overrated. I have learned in my public lectures that public interest in diet lifestyle change that really works and is scientifically reliable is greater than some in the academic community are willing to admit. This method of investigating details out of context, what I call reductionism, and trying to judge complex relationships from the results, is deadly. It is even more damaging than the misbehavior of the small minority of scientists I discussed in Chapter 13. Unfortunately, this flawed way of investigating nutrition has become the norm. As a consequence, honest, hard-working, well-intentioned scientists around the world are trapped into making judgments about whole diet effects on the basis of individual nutrient studies, because that is where the funding is. The greatest danger is that reductionism science, standing naked from its larger environment, has come to be the gold standard. Indeed, I know many researchers who would even say that this is what defines good science. These problems are especially egregious in the investigation of vitamin supplements. As I noted at the beginning of the chapter, I spent over 3 years during the early history of the nutrient supplement business developing testimony for the Federal Trade Commission and the NAS in their court case against General Nutrition, Inc. I argued that specific health benefits for chronic diseases could not be claimed for isolated vitamins and minerals in supplement form. For this, I took a lot of heat from my colleagues who believed otherwise. Now, more than 25 years later, after hundreds of millions of dollars of research funding and billions of dollars of consumer spending, we have this conclusion from a survey of the evidence. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force concludes that the evidence is insufficient to recommend for or against the use of supplements of A, C, or E, multivitamins with folic acid, or antioxidant combinations for the prevention of cancer or cardiovascular disease. How many more billions of dollars must be spent before we understand the limitations of reductionist research? The endless stream of confusion generated by the misinterpretation of the findings of reductionist research undermines not only the entire science of nutrition, but also the health of America. An opportunity for a turning point? This is where this chapter ended in the first edition, with a warning about the consequences of reductionism in science. While that warning still holds, a lot has happened in the last decade, including the clarification regarding my own thinking that led to the writing of whole, as in holism, reductionism's opposite, the concept of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, as well as the low-carb fraud, which elaborates on how an emphasis on reductionism can lead to the idea that carbohydrate is the singular cause of diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and cancer, thus ignoring the infinite complexity of nutrition and its effect on the infinitely complex biology of our bodies. I am increasingly enthusiastic about initiating a conversation on the conflict between reductionism and holism, because it helps to explain nutrition as a scientific discipline, and to understand the emphasis on drugs in medical practice and the workings of contemporary scientific research itself. I did not personally create the concept of holism. It has long been used by many scholars and laypeople to describe the content and characteristics of a wide spectrum of topics. But I now realize that the concept of holism was becoming prominent for me, even during my time as a member of the 1982 NAS panel that produced the Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer Report that began this chapter. Two of its messages especially prompted my interest in the singular reductionist effects of nutrients. The committee's interest in the reported effect of dietary fat, especially saturated fat, on cancer, and the inferences on the effects of individual nutrients, for example vitamins, on cancer. Both presume the importance of single nutrient effects on one's health, such as the subtraction of dietary fat or the addition of micronutrients. These messages, one intended by our committee, reduction of dietary fat, and the other not, nutrient supplementation, offered me unusual insight into how we establish our research priorities and how this information is provided to and used by the public in the marketplace. 10 years later, I remain ambivalent both about our NAS report and many of the reductionism-oriented studies its findings led to, including the Nurses' Health Study, which continues to this day, now in its third generation of nurses. Without question, this study has been the most productive diet and health study ever conducted, with a vast collection of well-written professional reports. My original concern, however, remains. To my knowledge, all of these nurses, 238,000 plus, depending on which individual records are selected for analysis, still consume typical American diets, high in total fat, higher than average in protein, low in fruit and vegetable consumption, and high in animal products. Virtually none of these nurses appear to consume a WFPB diet like that described here, nor are they made aware of its benefits. In 2015, researchers involved in the Nurses' Health Study published a review of the advantages and disadvantages of varied epidemiological study designs. Although it is an excellent summary, it still refuses to even acknowledge the existence of a WFPB diet, despite the recent growth in its prominence, leading me to still conclude, as Professor Willett previously suggested to me, people don't want to go there. Interestingly, much of the evidence in this Harvard summary may even support the benefits of the WFPB diet, but because individual nutrient associations mostly exist as fragments that are not merged into a larger dietary perspective, this support is hard to discern. The evidence against supplement use has also continued to grow during this past decade. According to The Economist, in 2015, there were 85,000 kinds of pills, powders, and elixirs in America alone. It is difficult to know the size of the market, depending on who reports the estimate. The industry estimate is $37 billion, but this has been challenged as inflated, and a much more conservative estimate says $12 billion. The Economist says supplement sales were $88 billion worldwide in 2014. Part of this disparity depends on which dietary supplement group is included in the estimate. Regardless of what is the best estimate, it is a huge industry that has grown continuously since the first edition of this book. Yet, during this same period, still more studies have found varied nutrient supplements to have no effect or even increase disease risk. A meta-analysis of 89 studies found that omega-3 fats found in fish oil do not have a clear effect on total mortality, combined cardiovascular events, or cancer. Although not statistically significant, clinically important harm, cancer risk, could not be excluded. And in a study of 195,000 individuals followed for 14 to 18 years that resulted in 9,380 type 2 diabetes cases, higher consumption of long-chain omega-3 fat supplements was highly significantly associated with increased risk of disease. Interestingly, even fish as a source of long-chain omega-3 fats was significantly associated with increased disease risk. The researchers for the Women-Based Nurses' Health Study and the Men-Based Physicians' Health Study published a series of papers in 2009 on the health effects of nutrient supplements on their subjects that mostly showed the same lack of benefit, except for some cases where there was increased disease risk. Vitamin E and C supplementation did not reduce the risk of prostate or total cancer and had no beneficial effect on the risk of cataracts. Multivitamin supplementation barely reduced cataracts and had no effect on macular degeneration, cardiovascular events, and total mortality or total cancer. And vitamin C and E had no effects on total cancers, prostate cancer, or other site-specific cancers. The reasons for these studies mostly arose from associations observed for consuming these vitamins in whole food, but isolating them from their food context does not give the same effects. I also am not impressed with any findings so far regarding vitamin D supplementation for the prevention or treatment of chronic disease, including a study on its effects on breast cancer. The only benefit that might be significant in the recent series of vitamin D supplement studies is the minimal, only 14%, reduction of colorectal adenoma. These research findings, along with other similar findings during the last 10 years, tell us two important things. First, a huge amount of research money has been spent seeking the hoped-for benefits of nutrient supplements over a relatively short period of time. And second, few, if any, benefits have been demonstrated. Some supplements even increased disease risk. In a way, I'm glad this research was done. It means we now have clear evidence that the hoped-for health benefits of nutrient supplements are not forthcoming. But what a waste of money spent on selling nonsense. It is abundantly clear to me that the vitamin supplement industry has nothing to do with science and everything to do with marketing, nothing to do with the health for the many, and everything to do with wealth for the few. And in the process, this focus on supplemental nutrition has detracted from efforts to develop sound whole food nutrition information for the public, which would have taken far less cost and had far greater improvements in health. Chapter 15, The Science of Industry. What does every American spend money on several times a day? Eating. After a lifetime of eating, what do we all do? Die. a process that usually involves large costs as we try to postpone it for as long as possible. We're all customers of hunger and death, so there's a lot of money to be spent and made. Because of this, the food and health industries in America are among the most influential organizations in the world. The revenue they generate is staggering. Many individual food companies have over $10 billion in annual revenues. Kraft has revenues of roughly $18 billion a year. The Danone Group, an international dairy company based in France, operates the Danone brand and has revenues of almost $25 billion a year. And of course, there are the large fast food companies. McDonald's has revenues in excess of $25 billion a year, and Wendy's International generates almost $4 billion a year. Total food expenditures, including food bought by individuals, government, and business, were $1.24 trillion in 2010. The massive drug company Pfizer had $48 billion in revenue in 2015, while Eli Lilly and Company chalked up over $23 billion. Johnson & Johnson collected over $70 billion from selling their products. As of 2010, over $1 trillion has been riding on what we choose to eat and how we choose to treat sickness and promote health. That's a lot of money. Powerful players are competing for your food and health dollars. Individual companies, of course, do what they can to sell more of their products. But there are also industry groups that work to increase general demand for their products. The National Dairy Council, National Dairy Promotion and Research Board, National Fluid Milk Processor Promotion Board, International Sprout Growers Association, American Meat Institute, Florida Citrus Processors Association, and United Egg Producers are examples of such industry groups. These organizations, operating independently of any single company, wield significant influence. The most powerful among them have yearly budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars. These food companies and associations use whatever methods they can to enhance their products' appeal and grow their market. One way to accomplish this is to claim nutritional benefits for the food products they sell. At the same time, these companies and associations must protect their products from being considered unhealthy. If a product is linked to cancer or some other disease, profits and revenue will evaporate. Food business interests need to claim that their product is good for you, or at least that it's not bad for you. In this process, the science of nutrition becomes the business of marketing. The Airport Club. While I was getting the China Project off the ground, I learned of a committee of seven prominent research scientists who had been retained by the animal-based foods industry, the National Dairy Council, and the American Meat Institute, to keep tabs on any research projects in the U.S. likely to cause harm to their industry. I knew six of the seven members, four of them quite well. A graduate student of mine was visiting with one of these scientists and was given a file on the committee activity. I have never learned exactly why the file passed hands. Perhaps the scientist's conscience was getting the better of him. In any case, the file was ultimately given to me. The file contained minutes of committee meetings, the latest being held at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. From then on, I have called this group of scientists the Airport Club. It was run by Professors E.M. Foster and Michael Pariza, faculty members of the University of Wisconsin, where Alf Harper was located, and was funded by the meat and dairy industry. This committee's main objective was to have members observe projects that might do harm to their industry. With such surveillance, the industry could more effectively respond to unexpected discoveries from researchers that might make otherwise unanticipated news. I had learned well that when the stakes are high, industry was not averse to putting its own spin on a story. They listed about nine potentially damaging projects, and I had the dubious distinction of being the only researcher responsible for two of them. I was named once for the China Project, which one of the members was assigned to watch over, and once for my association with the American Institute for Cancer Research, AICR, especially my chairing of the review panel that decided which research applications on diet and cancer got funded. Another panel member had the task of keeping an eye on the AICR activity. After learning of the airport club and of the individual assigned to watch over me at the AICR grant meetings, I was in a position to see how his spying was going to unfold. I went into the first AICR review panel meeting after learning of the club, with an eye on the spy who was keeping an eye on me. One might argue that this industry-funded spying was not illegal, and that it is prudent for a business to keep tabs on potentially damaging information that might affect its future. I agree completely, even if it was disconcerting to find myself on the list of those being spied on. But industry does more than just keep tabs on dangerous research. It actively markets its version, regardless of potentially disastrous health effects, and corrupts the integrity of the science to do so. This is especially troubling when academic scientists do the spying and hide their intentions. Powerful groups. The dairy industry, one of the sponsors of the Airport Club, is particularly powerful in this country. Founded in 1915, the well-organized, well-funded National Dairy Council has been promoting milk for over 100 years. In 1995, two major milk industry groups put a new face on their old establishment, renaming it Dairy Management, Inc. The purpose of this new group was to do one thing, increase demand for U.S.-produced dairy products, to quote their website. They had a 2003 marketing budget of more than $165 million to do it. In comparison, the National Watermelon Promotion Board has a budget of $1.6 million. A Dairy Management, Inc. press release includes the following items. Rosemont, Illinois, national, state, and regional dairy producer directors have approved a budget of $165.7 million for a 2003 Unified Marketing Plan, UMP, designed to help increase dairy demand. Major program areas include fluid milk. In addition to key ongoing activities in advertising promotion and public relations efforts targeted to children ages 6 to 12 and their mothers, 2003 dairy checkoff efforts will focus on developing and extending partnerships with major food marketers, including Kellogg's, Kraft Foods, and McDonald's. School marketing. As part of an effort to guide school-age children to become lifelong consumers of dairy products, 2003 activities will target students, parents, educators, and school food service professionals. Programs are underway in both the classroom and the lunchroom, where dairy checkoff organizations look to widen the success of last year's school milk pilot test. Dairy image slash confidence. This ongoing program area aims to protect and enhance consumer confidence in dairy products and the dairy industry. A major component involves conducting and communicating the results of dairy nutrition research showing the healthfulness of dairy products, as well as issues and crisis management. If I may paraphrase the dairy industry's efforts, their goals are to 1. Market to young children and their mothers. 2. Use schools as a channel to young customers. 3. Conduct and publicize research favorable to the industry. Many people are not aware of the dairy industry's presence in our schools. But make no mistake, on nutrition information, the dairy industry reaches young children more effectively than any other industry. It has enlisted the public education system as the primary vehicle for increasing demand for its products. The 2001 Dairy Management, Inc. annual report stated, "As the best avenue to increase fluid milk consumption long-term, children are without a doubt the future of dairy consumption. That's why the Dairy Checkoff continues to implement school milk marketing programs as one way to help increase kids' fluid milk consumption. dairy producers launched two groundbreaking initiatives in 2001, a year-long school milk research program that began in the fall of 2001 examines how improved packaging, additional flavors, coolers with merchandising, and better temperature regulation can affect fluid milk consumption and kids' attitudes toward milk, both in and out of school. The study concludes at the end of the 2001 to 2002 school year. Also, dairy producers and processors worked together to conduct a 5-month vending study in middle and high schools in 5 major U.S. markets. The study revealed that many students would choose milk over competitive beverages if it were available, when, where, and how they wanted. Many other successful school programs continue to encourage children to drink milk. Nutrition education programs such as Pyramid Explorations and Pyramid Cafe teach students that dairy products are a key part of a healthy diet. The Cold is Cool program teaches school cafeteria managers how to keep milk cold, just how kids like it. And the Checkoff is helping expand dairy-friendly school breakfast programs. In addition, the popular Got Milk? Campaign continues to reach children at school and through such kid-focused media outlets as Nickelodeon and the Cartoon Network. These activities are far from small scale. In 1999, Chef Combo's Fantastic Adventures, an educational marketing set of lesson plans produced by the dairy industry, was placed in 76% of preschool kindergarten sites nationally. According to a dairy industry report to Congress, the dairy industry's nutrition education programs are doing quite well. Pyramid Cafe and Pyramid Explorations, targeted to second and fourth grades, reach over 12 million students with messages that milk and dairy products are a key part of a healthy diet. Survey results continue to show a very high utilization rate for these two programs, currently at over 70% of the instructors that have the programs. America is entrusting the important task of educating our children about nutrition and health to the dairy industry. In addition to ubiquitous nutrition lesson plans and educational kits, the industry supplies high schools with videos, posters, and teaching guides regarding nutrition. It runs special promotions in cafeterias to increase milk consumption in thousands of schools. It distributes information to principals at national conferences. It runs back-to-school promotions with over 20,000 schools, and it runs sports promotions targeted toward youth. Should we be worried? In a word, yes. If you are curious as to what kind of education is being taught by the dairy industry, take a look at their website. When I visited the site in July 2003, one of the first bits of information to greet me was, "July is National Ice Cream Month." Upon clicking for more information on National Ice Cream Month, I read, "If you're wondering if you can have your ice cream and good nutrition too, the answer is yes." Great. So much for combating childhood obesity and diabetes. The website is divided into 3 sections, one for educators, one for parents, and one for food service professionals. When I looked at the site in July 2003, it regularly changes its content. In the educator portion of the site, teachers could download lesson plans to teach nutrition to their classrooms. Lesson plans included making hand puppets of cows and dairy foods and doing a finger play. Once the puppets are made, the teacher should tell the students they're going to meet 5 special friends, and these friends want boys and girls to grow up to be strong and healthy. Another lesson was Dairy Treat Day, where each child gets to taste cheese, pudding, yogurt, cottage cheese, and ice cream. Or teachers could lead their classes in making moo masks. For the more advanced fourth grader, teachers could do a lesson plan from Pyramid Explorations in which students explore the 5 food groups and their health benefits as follows. Milk group, build strong bones and teeth. Meat group, build strong muscles. Vegetable group, help you see in the dark. Fruit group, helps heal cuts and bruises, Grain Group, give us energy. Based on the evidence presented in the previous chapters, you know that if this is what our children are learning about nutrition and health, then we are in for a painful journey, courtesy of Dairy Management, Inc. Obviously, neither kids nor their parents are learning about how milk has been linked to type 1 diabetes, prostate cancer, osteoporosis, multiple sclerosis, or other autoimmune diseases, and how casein, the main protein in dairy foods, has been shown to experimentally promote cancer and increase blood cholesterol and atherosclerotic plaque. In 2002, this marketing website delivered over 70,000 lesson plans to educators. The dairy industry truly is teaching its version of nutrition to the next generation of Americans. The industry has been doing this for decades, and it has been successful. I have encountered many people who, when they hear about the potential adverse effects of dairy foods, immediately say, "Milk can't be bad." Usually, these people don't have any evidence to support their position. They just have a feeling that milk is good. They've always known it to be that way, and they like it that way. You can trace some of their opinions back to their school days, when they learned that there are 7 continents, 2 + 2 = 4, and milk is healthy. If you think about it this way, you will understand why the dairy industry has had such exceptional influence in this country by using education for its marketing purposes. If this marketing program weren't such a widespread threat to our children's health, it would be downright laughable that an industry group would try to peddle its food product under such a thinly veiled education plan. Don't people wonder what's going on when almost every single children's book advertised in the nutrition bookshelf portion of this website revolved around either milk, cheese, or ice cream, with such titles as Ice Cream, Great Moments in Ice Cream History? After all, during July 2003, there were no vegetable books anywhere to be found on this nutrition bookshelf. Aren't they healthy? At least when the dairy industry describes all of these school-related activities in the official reports to Congress and in industry press releases, it rightly refers to them as marketing activities. Conjugated linoleic acid. The dairy industry doesn't stop with kids. For adults, the industry puts a heavy emphasis on science and the communication of research results that might be construed as showing health benefits from eating dairy foods. The dairy industry spends $4 to $5 million a year to fund research toward the goal of finding something healthy to talk about. In addition, the dairy industry promoters employ a medical advisory board made up of doctors, academics, and other health professionals. These scientists are the ones who appear as medical professionals in the media, providing science-based statements supporting the health benefits of milk. The Airport Club was a good example of industry efforts to maintain favorable product image and confidence. In addition to keeping an eye on potentially damaging projects, the club was trying to generate research that might show that cancer could be prevented by drinking cow's milk. What a coup that would be! At that time, the industry was getting quite edgy about the growing evidence showing that the consumption of animal-based foods is associated with cancer and related ailments. Their hook for this research was an unusual group of fatty acids produced by bacteria in the cow's rumen, the biggest of the 4 stomachs. These fatty acids were collectively called conjugated linoleic acid, CLA, which is produced from the linoleic acid commonly found in corn that the cow eats. From the cow's rumen, CLA is then absorbed and gets stored in the meat and milk of the animal, eventually to be consumed by humans. The big payday for the Airport Club was when initial tests on experimental mice suggested that CLA might help to block the formation of stomach tumors produced by a weak chemical carcinogen called benzoapyrene. But there was a catch in the research. Researchers gave CLA to the mice first, and then gave the carcinogen benzoapyrene. The ordering of these chemical feedings was backwards. In the body, there is an enzyme system that works to minimize the amount of cancer caused by a carcinogen. When a chemical such as CLA is initially consumed, it excites that enzyme system so that it has increased activity. So the trick was to administer CLA first, to excite the enzyme system, and then administer the carcinogen. In this order, the enzyme system excited by CLA would be more effective at getting rid of the carcinogen. As a result, CLA could be called an anti-carcinogen. Let me give you an analogous situation. Let's say you have a bag of a potent pesticide in your garage. The pesticide bag says, "Do not swallow." In case of ingestion, contact your local poison control health authorities or some such warning. But let's say you're hungry and you eat a handful of pesticide anyway. That pesticide in your body will rev up the enzyme systems in all of your cells that are responsible for eliminating nasty things. If you then go inside and eat a handful of peanuts dripping with aflatoxin, your body's enzyme systems will be primed to deal with the aflatoxin, and you'll end up with fewer aflatoxin-induced tumors. So the pesticide, which will ultimately do all sorts of nasty things in your body, is an anti-carcinogen. This scenario is obviously absurd, and the research on mice that initially showed CLA to be an anti-carcinogen was similarly absurd. However, the end results of the mice research sounded pretty good to people who don't know this methodology, including most scientists. Airport Club member Michael Parisa headed the research that studied CLA in some detail. Later, at Roswell Park Memorial Institute for Cancer Research in Buffalo, a very good researcher and his group extended the research still further and demonstrated that it did more than merely block the first step in the formation of tumors. CLA also appeared to slow down subsequent tumor growth when fed after the carcinogen. This was a more convincing finding of the anti-cancer properties of CLA than the initial studies, which showed only an inhibition of tumor initiation. Regardless of how promising these mouse and cow studies were becoming, this research remained two major steps removed from human cancer. First, it had not been shown that cow's milk containing CLA as a whole food, as opposed to the isolated chemical CLA, prevents cancer in mice. Second, even if such an effect existed in mice, it would need to be confirmed in humans. In fact, as has been discussed earlier in this book, if cow's milk has any effect at all, it has been shown to increase, not decrease, cancer. The far more significant nutrient in milk is protein, whose potent cancer-promoting properties are consistent with the human data. In other words, to make any health claims regarding CLA in milk and its effect on human cancer would require unreasonably large leaps of faith. But never doubt the tenacity, that is, money, of those who would like to have the public believe that cow's milk prevents cancer. Lo and behold, a front-page headline in our local newspaper, the Ithaca Journal, stated, "Changing cows' diets elevates milk's cancer fighting." This article concerned the studies of a Cornell professor who was instrumental in the development of bovine growth hormone, now fed to cows. He showed that he could increase CLA in cow's milk by feeding the animals more corn oil, that is, linoleic acid, the parent of CLA. The Ithaca Journal article, although only in a local hometown newspaper, really was a dream come true for the sponsors of the Airport Club. The headline delivers a powerful but very simple message to the public: drinking milk reduces cancer risk. I know that media people like punchy statements, so initially I suspected that the reporter had made claims beyond what the researchers had said. But in the article, the enthusiasm expressed by Professor Bauman for the implications for this research equaled that of the headline. The study cited in this article only showed that CLA is higher in the milk of cows fed corn oil. That's a long way from having any relevance to human cancer. No studies had yet shown that humans or even mice drinking cow's milk had a lower risk of cancer, of any kind. Yet Bauman, who was a technically competent researcher, was quoted as saying that these findings have a good potential because CLA happens to be a very potent anti-carcinogen. The journalist went on to say, CLA has been shown to suppress carcinogens and inhibit the spread of colon, prostate, ovarian, and breast cancers and leukemia, and concluded that all indications are that CLA is effective in humans, even in low concentrations. According to the article, Bauman says that this research represents the new focus on designing foods to enhance their nutritional and health qualities. These claims could not be more dramatic, considering the absence of the necessary human research. Bauman, Parisa, and their many other colleagues have vigorously pursued this line of research for about 15 years and have published a large number of research papers. Although additional beneficial effects of CLA are said to exist, the key research still has not been done, namely testing whether the consumption of milk from cows fed high corn oil diets really will reduce human cancer risk. In addition, Bauman and his colleagues have attempted to take a step toward finding this essential connection. They have shown that the milk fat of cows fed high amounts of natural CLA in corn oil, like synthetic CLA, was able to decrease tumors in rats treated with a carcinogen. But again, they used the tricky experimental method. They administered the milk fat before, not after, the carcinogen. Yet their claims will be as dramatic as ever, because this is the first time that CLA, as present in food, that is, the fat, is shown to be as anti-carcinogenic as the isolated chemical. Translated? Eat butter from cows fed corn oil. It prevents cancer. The science of industry. The CLA story is a good example of how industry uses science to increase demand for its product to make more money. At the very least, industry science often leads to public confusion. Are eggs good? Are they bad? And at its worst, industry science leads unsuspecting consumers to foods that are actually bad for them, all in the name of better health. Conflicts of interest abound in this science of industry. The CLA research was created with special interest money and has grown and been sustained with special interest money. The National Dairy Council, Kraft Foods, Inc., the Northeast Dairy Foods Research Center, the Cattlemen's Beef Board, and the Cattlemen's Beef Association have frequently funded these studies. Corporate influence in the academic research world can take many forms, ranging from flagrant abuses of personal power to conflicts of interest, all hidden from public view. This influence does not need to be a crass payoff to researchers to fabricate data. That sort of behavior is rare. The more significant way for corporate interests to influence academic research is much more sophisticated and effective. As illustrated by the CLA example, scientists investigate a detail out of context that can be construed as a favorable message, and industry exploits it for all it's worth. Almost no one knows where the CLA hypothesis started and who originally funded it. Few people really question such research if it is published in the best journals. Very few people, especially among the public, know which studies are benefiting from direct corporate funding. Very few people are able to sort out the technical details and recognize the missing information that would otherwise establish context. Almost everyone, however, understands that headline in my local newspaper. I could play this game too, if I wanted to hurt the dairy industry and be a little wild in my interpretation of study results. I could produce another headline to say, "New birth control chemical discovered in cow's milk." Research has shown, for example, that CLA dramatically kills chick embryos. Also, CLA increases the tissue level of saturated fats that could, using our dramatic method of interpretation, exacerbate heart disease risk. Of course, I have taken these two unrelated effects grossly out of context in my example. I don't really know whether these CLA effects actually translate into less fertility and more heart disease for humans. But if I were playing the game the way industry enthusiasts do, I wouldn't mind. It would make a great headline, and that can go a long way. I subsequently met with one of the members of the Airport Club, a scientist who has been involved in the CLA effort, and he confessed that the CLA effect will never be anything more than a drug effect. However, you can bet that what is known in private will not be told in public. Industry's love of tinkering. The Airport Club and CLA stories mostly tell a story about the dark side of science, which I detailed in Chapter 13. But the CLA story is also about the dangers of reductionism, of taking details out of context and making claims about diet and health, which I discussed in the previous chapter. Like academia, industry is also an essential player in the system of scientific reductionism that undermines the knowledge we have about dietary patterns and disease. Industry, you see, loves to tinker. Securing patents based on details leads to marketing claims and, ultimately, to greater revenues. In a 1999 paper by several CLA researchers, including Professor Dale Bauman, a longtime friend of the animal foods industry, the following sentence appeared, revealing much about how some industry enthusiasts feel as we tinker our way to health. The concept of CLA-enriched foods could be particularly appealing to people who desire a diet-based approach to cancer prevention without making radical changes in their eating habits. I know that, for Bauman and others, making radical changes in eating habits means consuming a diet rich in plant-based foods. Rather than avoiding bad foods altogether, these researchers are suggesting that we tinker with the existing but problematic foods to correct the problem. Instead of working with nature to maintain health, they want us to rely on technology, their technology. This faith in technological tinkering in humans over nature is ever present. It is not limited to the dairy industry, or the meat industry, or the processed foods industry. It has become part of every single food and health industry in the country, from oranges to tomatoes, from cereals to vitamin supplements. The plant food industry got carried away in the early 2000s when another carotenoid was discovered. You probably heard of it. It is called lycopene, and it provides the red color in tomatoes. In 1995, it was reported that people who ate more tomatoes, including whole tomatoes and tomato-containing foods like pasta sauces, had a lower risk for prostate cancer, which supported an earlier report. For those companies that make foods with tomato products, this was a gift from above. Marketing people in the corporate world quickly got the message, but what they zeroed in on was lycopene, not tomatoes. The media, willing to oblige, rose to the occasion. It was lycopene time. Suddenly, lycopene became widely known as something to eat more of if you don't want prostate cancer. The scientific world, investigating details, escalated its efforts to decipher the lycopene magic. As of 2015, the National Library of Medicine listed 3,653 scientific publications on lycopene. A major market is underway, with trade names like Lycopene 10 Cold Water Dispersion and Lycovit 10% to be used as food supplements. If you only listen to their health claims, we might be on the way to bringing prostate cancer, a leading cancer among men, under control. There are, though, a couple of disquieting thoughts. First, after spending millions of research and development dollars, there is some doubt whether lycopene, as an isolated chemical, can prevent prostate cancer. According to one review publication, six studies now have shown a statistically significant decrease in prostate cancer risk with increased lycopene intake. 3 non-statistically significant studies agree, and 7 studies show no association. But these studies measured lycopene intake.